Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. This is my colleague and co-host, Sam Wong.
Sam Wong, neuroscientist and founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
There are a few issues, Sam, as important and as urgent as climate change. We're in the middle of a scientific, economic, political struggle to literally save the planet. We've been learning the science of how human activity has eroded our climate for many decades now, with different pieces of the puzzle being filled in, and environmental activists and scientists struggling to bring attention to the issue and to take steps to reverse what's being done. But climate change policy has suffered many blows over the years. Numerous administrations, members of Congress have not done enough, either because they don't want to or because they don't believe what's happening. The current administration has really led an effort to reverse many of the regulations that we have put in place and allied with some of the forces who have been fighting both the policies and the science for many decades. To discuss the threats that we face, the challenges that we face as a nation and throughout the entire world, we have with us today Jeff Nesbitt, who is the Director of Public Affairs for two federal science agencies, the National Science Foundation and the Food and Drug Administration. And he was also Communications Director to Vice President Dan Quayle, who was, of course, the Vice President to George H.W. Bush, who recently passed away. He's currently the Executive Director of Climate Nexus, and he contributes to many publications, including the New York Times. And today we're going to be able to discuss his new book, This is the Way the World Ends, which was published by St. Martin's Press, a book which Bill McKibben called a touchstone book for understanding the world we're creating. Mr. Nesbitt, welcome to our show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Maybe we can start. I'm adding a question on the spot, but obviously you did serve in the administration of George H.W. Bush, who passed away. Could you maybe share with listeners where the administration was, and this was from 1989 to 1993, where they were on issues of the environment and climate change?
Sure, I'd be happy to. You know, that question's come up recently for obvious reasons. It's interesting. Somebody showed me a clip of the vice presidential debate between Lloyd Benson and Dan Quayle, and everybody remembers that debate because that's where Benson delivers the famous line about Jack Kennedy that he was a friend of mine. That's what people remember from that. But there was actually a climate question in that debate.
Weird.
And Dan Quayle's answer was arguably better than Benson's was. Benson promoted fossil fuels because he was from Texas and he promoted, you know, energy independence and the use of fossil fuels and oil. And Quayle just talked about the risks of that, you know, greenhouse gases were presenting to the human population and that we needed to do something about it. So I think the simplest answer is this was, you know, the late 1980s, early 1990s. The scientists knew quite well what was going on. That was right about the time Jim Hansen was testifying. The scientists knew, but the politicians didn't know really what to do or how grave the situation was even at that time. So what you see was them basically wrestling with what to do. What do you do internationally with treaties, you know, in Rio and Kyoto? What do you do politically in front of Congress? What should you do in an administration when the science was quite a bit more clear at the time than the politics were? So that was the state of play at the time. It was just the politics of climate were just beginning right then.
And maybe then that's a perfect way to turn to your book and what you've written about. Maybe you can tell us a little bit of what do we know now? And I think for many people who read about it a little bit or who follow it, it's become very confusing because of the political debates. But what do we know about climate change, what it's doing, what some of its manifestations are today?
So if you don't mind, let me try to make it a whole lot less confusing.
Okay. that's exactly what we want.
Hooray.
The climate science, there is no climate science debate. That is effectively settled. And And that's in the book that I've written. I cite endless lists of studies. Thousands and thousands of scientists have been screaming at the top of their lungs for the last 20 years about what's happening. There should be no confusion whatsoever about that. Do we know how bad it's going to get? Sure, that's what science does, and that they'll continue to study that. But the mere fact that it's bad for us human beings, is effectively a settled fact at this point. And I could walk you through umpteen examples. Half of species on Earth are experiencing local extinctions. The amount of surface area on the Earth that's now experiencing extreme heat events has increased 20-fold in just a generation. There are big, bold science statistics like that, but nobody should be confused about that aspect of it. The science is effectively settled. We are in a lot of trouble right now, and species and other parts of the Earth are experiencing truly awful things, like running out of water in Yemen and Somalia, food scarcity issues all across the sub-Saharan region, and threats from extreme weather events. So put that off to the side. There should be no confusion about that. The only people who like to try to confuse that are the folks who speak to about 20% of the American population who choose to be confused about this. The rest of the country, about 75 to 80% of the country, they're not confused anymore. They know what's going on. But now, get to the politics of it, which is, I think, what you want to talk about. That is an entirely different story, because there, one party doesn't know what to do about it and either says nothing, or some of its leaders in the Republican Party say, we don't know enough and let's not deal with this, to the Democrats who now view this as a wedge issue. When you look at younger voters, they look even self-identified Republican voters look a lot like Democrats on this issue. The Democrats know this. So going forward, this will be a wedge issue for the Democratic Party.
And before we turn to the politics, in terms of the effects it's having, is it an equal opportunity destroyer? Meaning, are there certain parts of the world that are feeling this more severely or in different ways? Or are those distinctions not that relevant?
They're entirely relevant. That's actually one of the big themes of the book. but before I talk about that briefly, I wanted to sort of course correct a little bit. People like to talk about saving the planet. Truth is, we don't need to save the planet. The planet's going to be just fine. It's us human beings who might not be, and species all across the world right now are, because they don't know what's confronting them. Are trying to deal with this. So here's the unfortunate part about the climate threat is that it's much graver right now in other parts of the world. And the clearest way to describe this is scientists have been talking about the subtropics, which are on either side of the equator, for a long time, that they would start to experience extreme droughts, extreme heat, extreme precipitation and downpours, and that they would start to see that sooner than the rest of the world would. And that's precisely what's happening now. When you look at the countries in and around the Horn of Africa, they're effectively out of water. It's why Yemen ran out of water effectively probably 4 or 5 years ago. Saudi Arabia drained its own aquifer quite foolishly, and they're now struggling for fresh water. North China is struggling. So those parts within the subtropics around either side of the equator are experiencing things right now that are catastrophic in nature. Somalia, half the country in Somalia is facing either food scarcity or water scarcity, and may never be livable again because of the nature of the climate impacts in that part of the world. When you get to the United States, we're really fortunate because we're in a temperate zone. We're in a traditionally sort of the sweet spot on the planet, so we don't see the extreme events. They tend to only touch our shores when a big hurricane hits and drops 50 inches of water in Houston, or a Category 5 storm obliterates Puerto Rico, or threatens South Florida or the eastern coastline. We see it when saltwater intrusion is causing harm along the coastlines, and we see a little bit in the extreme heat events in the Midwest and the changing in the agricultural seasons in the Midwest and the Southeast, and of course some water scarcity issues along the Colorado River Basin. But by and large, in America, we're pretty fortunate. We're a rich country. We can adapt, and we're not seeing the worst impacts. That is not the case around the rest of the world, and that's mostly what the book walks through.
I want to maybe drill in just a little bit into the science. There's obviously lots of political stuff to talk about, but I just want to drill a little bit into the science, because you set that up as a kind of a setup as to where you head in the book. I want to talk a little bit about just a few points. One is this person who you interviewed at Stanford, Terry Root, I think is her name.
Mm-hmm.
And she talks and use her story to talk about range shifts. So just to give a sense, because this feels like powerful evidence, give us a sense for what range shifts tell us about climate change and how they tell us what's happening.
So Terry Root, the entire world should be thanking Terry Root extensively. Terry, she was married to Stephen Schneider, sort of the godfather of climate science. Terry is maybe the most prominent biodiversity expert in the world. She's now emeritus at Stanford, but it was her initial studies where she asked the question, is climate change affecting the migration of birds all across North America? Are they leaving earlier? Are they changing what they're doing? Are they trying to adapt? And so she started to study the migration of birds, and what she found was, yes, they are. They're all changing. It was the very first study, and then she, then began to add up additional studies, and she was the lead author of the first biodiversity report under the United Nations. Other studies started to confirm what she was doing, and eventually she was able to show that pretty much every single migratory bird in North America was being impacted by climate change. They were either, leaving earlier, leaving later, moving north to get away from the heat, but they were all being affected. And that was an astounding discussion to begin in the science community that, wow, all of this is happening right now. You fast forward to today, all of her colleagues are chronicling the collapse of species, at least locally, all across the planet. Like I said before, there are some studies that are showing half of all species on Earth are experiencing local extinctions, which means the climate has changed so much they can't adapt fast enough, so they die out in that part of the Earth.
And you say 4/5 of species have moved towards the poles.
They all, yes, which is, so the species which can't talk to each other, they're experiencing this. They're mute, though, because they're animals. They can only talk to us with their actions. And their actions are telling us, really loudly and quite clearly, something is happening on Earth right now, not in 2100, not 80 years from now, but right now. And that's what Terry Root said. And in my book, I had interviewed her for a series, I was asking her relatively simple questions. What did you find? What's happening? And she kept breaking down on camera. And the reason why, after we've shut the cameras off and we just sort of talked it through, was that she felt like she had failed in her effort. She had discovered this phenomenal thing that everybody needed to understand and know about, and it had become a political thing, and whole swaths of people simply didn't believe the science, and she didn't understand it, and she didn't know, she felt like she had failed. Now, of course, she had, and she's a hero, and people like Terry Root should be held up as heroes because they're telling us and have told us quite clearly what's going on. But she really struggled. And I think a lot of scientists struggle with that as well. You know the truth, but then how do you tell the rest of the world about it?
Well, I think it's through storytelling. I mean, if I look through your book, the kind of storytelling that's here is, as we get stuck on, yes, it's happening, no, it's not happening, you're a bunch of dirty liberals. But look, you've got a whole chapter here about the third pole, about something I didn't know about, like what, the Himalayas are melting? I mean, this is going to create a water problem for half the population of Asia. Let's hear about that a little bit, because these stories are really something.
Well, thank you. And I'm a storyteller at heart, so I believe that, that's how people learn. Long before there were, businessmen and doctors and lawyers, there were storytellers. So we tend to latch onto a story, and then that's how we learn. So in China, what is just now emerging is China's been sponsoring some researchers who've literally been measuring even the smallest of glaciers up in the Himalayas, which they call colloquially, the third pole, which, you know, it's the top of the world. And there are thousands and thousands of these small glaciers all throughout the Himalayas. Yes, there are really big ones, and they're melting too. But what the Chinese researchers have and they've just now started to sort of report out to the world, is that the smaller ones have completely melted away. In one small part of the Himalayas, where this one researcher has been meticulously studying glaciers every year for the last 50 years, 500 glaciers, small ones, are gone. Just gone. They're gone. And they're just now starting to tell the world about that. So what that means is there's both a short-term and a long-term implication. In the short term, when these glaciers melt, obviously there's runoff, like in that year, and so it creates some water. But then it's not replenished. And so what should be terrifying to people is that when and if the glaciers significantly melt in the third pole in the next whatever period of time, say 15 to 20 years, there'll be some water, but then it'll run out, and it won't replenish the aquifers, it won't replenish the river systems, and that's why China right now is making moves all over the world, because it has to assure that there's fresh water and food for more than a billion people in their country. So it's why they're buying 2/3 of the soybeans on Earth, and will probably be importing every soybean planted on Earth within the next 10 years. It's because of what's going on in the Himalayas, as well as what's the advance of the Gobi Desert in northern China.
Now, it seems like so much of this is the story of water, which is obvious once it's said. But I want to hear a little bit maybe about, just to connect it to politics, to try to get people who mm-hmm. are really driven by politics. How did water, like you talked about China water, how did water in, say, Syria or in the Middle East lead to events like the Arab Spring and the refugee crisis in Syria?
So let's talk about Yemen, which is everybody on Earth should understand the true story of what happened in Yemen. And it's really evident in some of the early cables that were released by WikiLeaks. And it's funny, they were released by WikiLeaks. They accessed all the State Department cables when Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State. That was the sort of first big WikiLeaks release, and everybody focused on lots of other things. Well, in the middle of all those cables was the story of Yemen. And what happened in Yemen was this. There are 16 aquifers sort of across the country, and the NGOs on the ground and others who study this were telling the water minister and the leadership of Yemen, you are running out of water. 14 of your 16 aquifers have gone bone dry. You're reduced to 2, and without water, there is no hope. And they were predicting 2-3 years before the government collapsed, you've run out of water. What's left of the water, people are hoarding, and warlords are hoarding it, and or growing it for cod, which is a narcotic product that half the population uses. There isn't any water left for food. You don't have enough money to buy food. Your government is going to collapse over this fight over natural resources, specifically water. 2 years later, that is precisely what happened. And the water minister and the cabinet around the leadership in Yemen never made a move, never did anything. And then the water wars erupted in the streets, chaos ensued, and made way for the mess we see now. So there are other countries that have gone through something similar. Somalia's in that sort of state. Syria is another good example. New York Times reporters and others have done great work, and scientists have corroborated that when in Syria, when the extended drought came in, farmers all left their farms because nothing was working. They went to cities where there are no jobs, and they joined movements that led to civil unrest. So either lack of food or lack of water has been a primary driver of instability in places like Yemen, Syria, the Arab Spring, uprisings in Egypt and other places across sub-Saharan Africa, including every single country in the Sahel region across North Africa.
You say one of the interesting parts of your book is, and this grows out of your career as a journalist in communications, is that the stories matter, as you said, and the way we talk about this will have an impact on the politics of the issue. How confident are you that the power of persuasion through words and stories is enough to undercut some of the power of money and interests, which is the other side of politics on this issue?
Yeah. Well, eventually the stories will all catch up to all of us. Let's hope that doesn't happen at a time when there's really literally nothing we can do about it. We still have some time. We have 10 to 15 years to figure this out and to make some changes. That's not a lot of time. I'll say this. I'm quite confident that eventually the stories will matter to everybody because it'll become so apparent what's happening. Right now, the stories need to break through about what's happening in other parts of the world, what's starting to happen in the United States, and that there's still time for us to make some big important moves on this issue. Now, will we do it? I happen to be an optimist. I think we will. And part of the reason why I'm an optimist is that I've been through some big fights like this in the past. And the clearest example is I was the crazy person way back when I was at the Food and Drug Administration. I was the person who proposed that the FDA regulate the tobacco industry. That was my psychotic idea. And I pressed really hard when I was there, both when I was an associate commissioner and then the chief of staff, to make it happen. I engaged in that. I was, in the middle of the tobacco wars for probably close to 15 years, all across the board, from FDA jurisdiction over tobacco through the loss of the Supreme Court and then the legislation that eventually granted the FDA jurisdiction. The ban on marketing to kids, the truth campaign, the global tobacco settlement, I was in the middle of all of that. And in all of those cases, the stories really mattered, especially to kids. In the beginning, we thought that scaring kids about smoking would have an impact, and what we discovered was it had zero impact. Kids, generally teenagers, think they're immortal. They don't care what happens when they're 50. Preaching at them that, you wish you didn't have lung cancer when you were in your 50s so that you'd miss seeing your grandkids, didn't care. What they did care about was that the tobacco companies had lied to them and deliberately hooked them. That's what they cared about. And so once those stories started to matter to kids, you saw smoking rates fall right off the cliff. From a high of, say, 40%, nearly 40% of teenagers are smoking 25 years ago, 20 years ago, to single digits now. We'll put to the side the discussion over vaping e-cigarettes that deliver pure nicotine. But the traditional cigarette, those stories mattered in that fight. So I think eventually, and hopefully sooner rather than later, those same sorts of stories will matter in the climate fight. They haven't yet, but I think they will sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and I mean, the importance, obviously, with climate change is, while, as you show very clearly, there are many, many visible manifestations all over the world right now of what's happening. Unlike a war, for example, it isn't as visible. So that creates space for the deniers to step in and say nothing's happening or this is some kind of false science, et cetera, et cetera. And so there the storytelling really matters in terms of the proponents to make sure those kinds of false claims are rebuked.
Yeah, they do. I will say this. It's interesting because the organization I run, we do polling quite frequently. And our polling is showing a couple of really interesting trends, even in the Republican Party. We'll put off to the side for that, like, virtually every Democrat now knows it's real and that we need to do something about it. About half the Republican Party voters now are there as well. They know something's happening. A majority of self-identified Republican voters know that 19 of the 20 hottest years in history, human history, are happened in the last 20 years. They know that extreme events are driven by climate change. They've seen it in Houston. They've seen it in South Florida. They've seen it, it's even on the news. So what hasn't happened yet politically is that the leadership, which, is what sends all these cues to most of the Republican voters, they haven't figured this out yet. They're completely trapped inside of a box canyon. They don't know what to do. They don't know where to go, what to act on. But when half or more of the voters are in one place on an issue, then I've got to believe that eventually Republican elites will figure this out, and they at least figure it out to the point where they simply can't stand around denial or delay for 50 years, that they're going to act. I hope that's the case, but you know, we're assuming that there will be a Republican Party that will act rationally over the next 10 to 15 years at the federal level, and I guess we'll see if that happens.
So let me pick up on that. What has happened to the Republican Party on this issue? Why have they moved so far away from the science, away from public opinion, and really down a rabbit hole of climate change denial? What's going on with the GOP that's so different than when you were in the administration and these issues, with limited knowledge, were at least being addressed?
So a couple of things. I hate to talk about an earlier book I've written, but I might as well, because it's called Poison Tea. And the very first chapter of that earlier book talks about an unholy alliance that was formed between Koch Industries and their front groups and the American tobacco industry, and which started 20 years ago, and it began around two taxes that were proposed by then President Clinton. One was an excise tax on cigarettes, and the other was a BTU tax on energy that Al Gore was proposing. And those two groups got together and said, "We need to take over the Republican Party on this issue so that they will never, ever, 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 ever pass a tax on anything." But their real target was to kill off an energy tax and to kill off an excise tax on cigarettes. But they surrounded it with all this Tea Party language. This was 10 years before the creation of the Tea Party. They surrounded it with all this stuff, and they did, in fact, take over the Republican Party. There's a reason why the Republican Party elite in Washington is dead set against any sort of a tax, a carbon tax, or you name it, they're against it. It's because of that unholy alliance. So you take that, and then you combine it with an effort by the fossil fuel industry that lasted for about 5 years to build out a coalition to do for climate change what earlier industries did on the cigarette industry, which was to convince the at least one national party that the science was uncertain. That lasted for maybe up to 10 years. It's sort of gone away now and has in the last, say, 10 years, the fossil fuel industry promoting that climate denial. But the echoes and the ghosts of all of those efforts still bomb through the halls of the Republican Party. So it's a combination of the two, deliberately effort to block action and taxes and maintain the status quo on the business political side, and then efforts probably 15 years ago that still echo today to spin up the uncertainty of science.
I want to turn towards away from politics, or kind of parallel to politics a little bit. And towards the end, you have a story in a section of your book called The Blueprint, which is about a story about how we as a species could deal with this. And I would characterize some of this as a race against time, where you talk about the boom in energy renewables, and that boom is happening. And the question is, will it happen in time?
That's the big question. So maybe the simplest way to think about this is, I mean, it's interesting. Guys like Bill Gates are finally getting interested in this, and I'm glad to see Gates get involved in this. He just dropped a sort of a very interesting assessment of the climate problem in his Gates notes, and he's starting to talk about this. And he's segmenting the problem. 25% of the problem is electricity, so the utility and electricity sector needs to go renewable as fast as possible. And then other sectors need to move as well. There isn't one sort of silver bullet that answers all of this. There are probably six or seven silver bullets we need to deal with this. But we can deal with them if we acknowledge the problem and then move quickly. So what I talk about in the blueprint is that we've actually seen this happen in other industries, and the clearest example is Google, or the rise of the tech industry. 20 years ago, when the National Science Foundation, where I was working, they gave Google its first $1 million. Google Inc. was formed in 1995. 20 years later, it's Google. But when it was happening 20 years ago, there was no massive tech industry. There was no concept that the internet would control the global economy. It was just an idea. We're in much the same place with renewable energy right now and a clean energy revolution. There isn't a big Google. There could be, there should be, there needs to be, but right now there's not. But with some moves, both at the federal level, federal government level, the federal research level, the private research level, plus some of the big betting financial institutions, they can create the Google of renewable energy. They can create the new agriculture player that figures out sustainable agriculture practices on a grand scale in each of those areas. We need that to happen, and that's only going to happen through anticipation of what a new industry can look like when we're going to replace we're going to replace $90 trillion in infrastructure in the next 15 years. All the analysts say that. So the question for the world is, do they want that to be a renewable energy, clean tech, green infrastructure that creates a brand new industry, or are they just going to build on the same old fossil fuel industry that's caused the problem? That's what's confronting us right now. And I'm arguing, let's take the former as fast as we possibly can and create a new industry and a whole bunch of new jobs along the way rather than, muddle along in the old way that's caused the problem.
It's interesting. In in this section of the book, you really have that storytelling thread going here where you say what you just said about $90 trillion. You say the free market forge is poised to refine a $90 trillion thing of beauty and wonder. And I just am fascinated by that because you also say that there's two separate conversations, and we know the Democratic side conversation. You say Republicans are comfortable talking about energy independence and economic freedom. And so you're turning the whole debate away from what Democrats like to talk about, environment and climate change, and towards energy independence. I that interests me a lot.
So, thank you. And I've been advocating for, a couple of years now that we need to have one conversation. We've been having two conversations in the United States for way too long around this issue. The Democrats are very comfortable with the science and the climate and the environmental discussion, so they focus on that. The Republicans are quite comfortable talking about energy. Energy dominance now is actually replaced energy independence. They're very comfortable talking about that. But the truth is, they're the exact same conversation. And if you start to think about it that way, then the energy conversation can come right alongside the climate and environmental and science conversation and become the same conversation. If we do that fast enough and commit across the board, everywhere, whether you want to call it, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal or Chuck Schumer's infrastructure play that he outlined in the Washington Post or even Donald Trump's infrastructure play, if you were to actually have the same conversation, we could get this done. It just requires thinking that way. I know I'm being, overly simplistic and potentially naive here, but nevertheless, it may be true. If we had one conversation about this, we could get this done. And that's the point. And that's actually why I wrote this book. It was because, first, everybody needs to understand, the science is settled. It's done. That debate, the most recent IPCC 1.5 report on the National Climate Assessment that was on the front page of every newspaper in America, that debate is done. People who the 20% of the population that still wants to argue that, fine. They can go off into the shadows and argue that we didn't land on the moon as well. But the rest of us want to have one conversation about what to do about this. We know the impacts. We know the science. Now the question is, what do we do about it? And I would argue there are a lot of people in the United States who want to have that one conversation.
Well, let me circle back here. Now that we've found some path forward that could conceivably bring the parties together, the people, as you just said, or have implied, the people who are not in the conversation are scientists. And I just want to come all the way back to the beginning of your book and ask your advice. I'm a working scientist, and so I'm curious about this. Your opening example is, we hear about Albert Einstein during World War II attempting to get Franklin Roosevelt interested in atomic weapons. And the bomb. And you say the hidden story of that is that he was ignored for a while. And I'm going to read a sentence, and I just want to read the sentence and get your advice. You say, scientists are routinely ignored by political and business leaders in the United States and around the world, no matter how right and prescient they might be about any given subject. And then you say that, you know, Roosevelt really didn't get going until he heard that Churchill and the British were going to do it.
Right.
So, okay, the political and business leaders are the ones holding the strings here, and we scientists can be right, but evidently nobody listens to us. So now what?
A few things. First, and part of my understanding, I mean, the entire time I was at the National Science Foundation, here you have the National Science Foundation, which supports most of the basic science in the United States, to independent science. You know, you've got NASA, which is federally funded scientists, and Department of Energy, federally funded scientists, and others. But the National Science Foundation funds basic scientific research everywhere all across America. They're not part of the cabinet. They have to speak through the presidential science advisor at OSTP, who currently doesn't exist for President Trump, hasn't in the first 2 years. So there's no science voice ever in the political halls and the discussions of the White House. And the reason I know that is I was also there. I mean, I had top secret clearance when I was at the White House. And the science discussions never make it to the political halls. So the question then becomes, how do those science discussions make it into the political halls? Well, one way is for scientists to run and become members of Congress. They have enormous power when they do that. So the current head of AAAS is a physicist who was a member of Congress. So we need more scientists engaged in the actual political discussion. They should run.
Our former congressman.
Yes, your former congressman, exactly. So that's one way. Second is to not be shy about making their voice known up on Capitol Hill, because the truth is, I know this for a fact, every single member of Congress trusts scientists when they come into their office. That's what I did when I was at the National Science Foundation. I took scientists up to the Hill all the time to meet with members of Congress. That's how I got the America Competes Act when it passed 92-8, which authorized doubling the National Science Foundation's budget. Was because scientists just went up the Hill all the time with me, and we just sat down and talked to the members of Congress and said, "Here's what's what. You want innovation? You want to advance, the United States agenda? You want to be powerful? Science makes you powerful. Science makes you innovative. Science actually helps you achieve as a nation." That message resonated, but it only happened when they actually had that discussion. So, I apologize to all my friends who are scientists, but they don't like to talk to journalists and they don't like to talk to politicians because they feel like it's sausage making and it's not pure. Well, it's not, but it's also necessary in democracy. Sam, I don't know if you remember this, but because Nate Silver's never let me forget that article I wrote about you for Wired magazine way back when.
Oh, geez, that was you. Oh, my goodness. Oh, I do remember that one. Oh, that was hilarious. Oh, wow. I didn't make the connection. That's you. That's good.
That was me. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Nate Silver, he has not forgotten. And his couple of guys, they regularly remind me of that.
You know, it's funny. We were feuding for quite some time, but after the 2016 election, Nate and I kind of made up. We had some emails, and it was much more friendly. I think 2016 was rough for anybody who was following.
Oh, man, it was rough for everybody. You kidding me?
Yeah. Wow. That is fascinating. Thank you for waiting until the end to tell me that.
All right. Well, I think that's an important and useful note to end the discussion on, and certainly an important connection that's going to need to happen in the coming years. So I want to thank our guest again, who has been Jeff Nesbitt, who is the author of really a terrific book that we urge you to read. This is The Way the World Ends, How Droughts and Die-Offs, Heat Waves and Hurricanes Are Converging on America, with St. Martin's Press, available everywhere books are sold. Thanks for joining the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And once again, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Goodbye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University, or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.